Please welcome the SDPA Fall Conference Medical Director, Dr. Heather Goff, to the stage. Dr. Goff is an associate professor in the Department of Dermatology at UT Southwestern Medical Center. She is a recognized leader in dermatology student education, training the next generation of dermatologists. She majored in fine arts in undergrad and still does pottery as a hobby.
Thank you all so much for having me. It's Carlos. It's going to be a very tough act to follow. And actually, one of the things I wanted to start with before I get into updates in mycosis fungoides and Sézary syndrome is sort of just talking about what I think the physician assistants bring to our department. We have, I think, 4 or 5 full-time physician assistants. Many of them are here at this conference. And I'm going to tell you all, as physician assistants, what I think, first, what I think the physician assistants in our department bring to our department, but also what I tell medical students when they're interviewing for residency positions in dermatology, many of whom are interested in careers in academic medicine, is that part of developing a subspecialty is a self-declarative process. For me, I didn't start off in medical school thinking I was going to be an expert in cosmetic dermatology or cutaneous lymphomas, but things sort of evolve, and when I interviewed for the position, I knew in academic medicine you need a niche, and I knew that there was a big clinic in cutaneous lymphomas, and I just sort of said, you know, I think I would like to do that. I knew the person who was doing it prior to me was sort of stepping down from that position, and I had some people that could offer me some mentorship, and I don't think that developing, you may, I don't know how you all feel in your various practices. Some of you may already have niches and subspecialties in which you sort of specialize in one particular condition. But if you aren't, and you feel like you may be part of a practice where you're sort of wearing a hat, where you're told to sort of churn and burn and just see a lot of patients, but you may have an interest in developing a niche, I think that one of the way that we're seen is sort of letting people know what we need or what we want. And we give people the opportunity to sort of see us or not see us. So if you have an interest in developing a niche, not necessarily in lymphomas, but in any condition, it can be sort of intimidating to say, hey, I want to be an expert in lymphoma. But what I'll tell you is what someone told me many years ago, when I said, you know, I think I might want to do lymphomas, but it feels sort of daunting, like, I've never done this before, and these are really complicated patients. And what they told me was that, you know, when you declare that you want to do that, after 2 or 3 months, you'll have seen more of those patients. Nobody wants to handle those patients. And so once you say you want to do that and you're seeing these patients after 2 or 3 months, you will have seen more of these patients than anybody else in your practice, and you actually will become the de facto expert because you've just seen and done more of that than anyone else. So for yourselves, if you have a particular disease that you find very interesting or you find very compelling, I think we all have the opportunity to develop niches and specialties in our clinical domain as dermatologists and as dermatology PAs. I know one of the PAs, I don't know if she's here, Ainsley Barnard, is now specializing in vulvar dermatoses with the mentorship of one of our other faculty. So so I think that opportunity is open to all of you, and so give your clinics the opportunity to see you if you have an interest in developing a specialty. With that, I'll move on to treatment of cutaneous lymphomas sort of as I do this. My first thing that I feel like is important to understand with cutaneous lymphomas is the background of skin immunity and how it develops in the skin. Then the phenotypes of mycosis fungoides and Sézary syndrome. We'll talk a little bit about diagnostics and biomarkers, and then we'll get into some targeted therapies. So by the end of this lecture, you're going to be able to recognize cutaneous manifestations of lymphomas. I think you'll be able to enumerate some good first-line treatments. We'll be able to enumerate some of the factors that distinguish between CD30-positive lymphoproliferative disorders and mycosis fungoides, and then clinical presentations that may portend a worse prognosis. So normal cutaneous T-cell biology, we all remember from back when we were in our medical training that you have an antigen that sort of reaches the surface of the skin. You have a Langerhans cell that's an antigen-presenting cell, grabs that epitope, and travels to a skin-draining lymph node where it will interact with a naive T cell. And then that naive T cell knows that that antigen-presenting cell came from the skin. That T cell will then differentiate into many different subclones of itself, many of which will develop skin homing properties. So that T cell will beget central memory T cells that live in the circulation and other T cells that are effector T cells that travel into the skin and develop skin homing properties and end up taking residence within the skin. This process propagates itself over and over again and takes place in all our various organs, so that essentially you have T cells that dwell in your lungs, you have T cells that dwell in your GI tract, and you have T cells that then take up residence in your skin. The T cells that migrate into your skin, I always a little bit hate slides like this because they are very complicated and there's a lot of numbers and graphics. But essentially, what's important to recognize here is that T cells then travel through the circulation. When they encounter an inflamed capillary bed, they will migrate into that tissue. And if they know that they're supposed to be a skin homing T cell, when they travel into the skin, they then undergo further differentiation and will take up permanent residence within the skin. The CD8 subclass of T cells that take up residence in your skin become highly epidermally restricted, whereas the CD4 cells can have various migratory capacity in order to either remain locked in the skin or to have the capacity to travel back into lymph nodes or into the bloodstream later on in life. And this is influenced by interaction with flora and our microbiome in the skin, which also plays a role in influencing the T cell differentiation within the skin. The important part of this slide here is essentially the green bar. What I want you to notice that in the skin, over a lifetime, from infancy to adulthood, you acquire more and more and more resident memory T cells within the skin. So you can see from childhood here, up to adulthood, that the effector memory versus the resident memory cell capacity within the skin grows and changes over time. To me, this explains not just the fact that things like mycosis fungoides are more common in adulthood, but to me, it also explains a lot of the pediatric dermatoses that we see that may have eosinophilic or neutrophilic inflammatory reactions in infancy, because you have a very naive T cell memory system in infancy. So when you encounter a new antigen, like new microbiome, new bacteria, new yeast, new whatever, new viruses, your immune system's like, what the heck? I don't know what to do with this. And it just throws a bunch of eosinophils or neutrophils at it because it hasn't got that effector or resident memory T cell process engaged yet. So when I think about mycosis fungoides and sensory syndrome, our immune system is always sort of going through this process of reaction and inflammation, but at some point your body has to sort of turn off that reaction and inflammation and develop some tolerance for what's going on. And in MF and Sézary syndrome, there's sort of a preponderance of an immunodeficient state or a state of persistent or overwhelming infections because of those malignant T cells are sort of dumb and don't function properly. And they also secrete cytokines that sort of inhibit the rest of our functional immune system. So with MF and Sézary syndrome, there's sort of the big four of what I think of with cutaneous T-cell lymphomas. There's mycosis fungoides, and there's sort of three subtypes that are recognized, the folliculotropic, granulomatous slack skin, and pagetoid reticulosis. There's also sort of what we call hypopigmented MF. It's not a technically recognized subset. It's usually CD8 positive. Also generally portends a very good prognosis. Sézary syndrome, which is a malignancy of the central memory T cell and usually presents with erythroderma. Lymphomatoid papulosis, which is not a malignancy, but is a CD30 positive lymphoproliferative disorder. And then there's anaplastic large cell lymphoma. When it's in the skin, it generally follows a benign course. So what is the difference between mycosis fungoides and Sézary syndrome? In MF, you basically have resident memory T cells that have taken up residence in the skin, and one of those CD8 positive T cells, and generally hypopigmented MF, or one of the CD4 positive, the more common state, CD4 positive T cells undergoes malignant degeneration, just like a basal cell or a squamous cell, but these are T cells, and so it's essentially a lymphoma, but it's a lymphoma that's generally restricted to the skin based on the migratory capacity of the malignant T cell that undergoes degeneration. Versus Sézary syndrome, where you remember that original APC in the naive T cell that beget central memory T cells that may recognize that original staph, let's say, but let's say that cell that dwells in your bloodstream that's looking for the staph and some other locus further later on down in life, that central memory T cell that dwells in the circulation with skin homing properties undergoes malignant degeneration and will traverse into the skin and cause generalized inflammation and erythroderma. So AMF is a relatively rare malignancy, even though it is the most common of the cutaneous T cell lymphomas. The incidence is only about 6 per million per year. There's it's a little more common in men than women, a little more common in African Americans than in whites. And it's definitely has a more poor prognosis in young African American women, and I would say young African American males. And any age group can be affected, but just because of how our immune system undergoes changes over time, it's more common in people that are older in life, in the fifth or sixth decades, typically. There's a point system criteria for the diagnosis where you're sort of like, do I favor if this is mycosis fungoides or, and so what you're looking for is sort of a classic presentation of fixed lesions in sun-protected sites. If you have both of those in a, that are following the classic morphology, you get 2 points. You need 4 points for diagnosis. And then you have the histopath of an atypical lymphocytic infiltrate with epidermotropism. You now have your 4 points and you're done. Now, if you only get one of those, let's say you only have a superficial lymphocytic infiltrate, you don't see full epidermotropism, but they are atypical, or you see epidermotropism, but not much atypia, you can look for things like if there's clonality and get a point for that, or you can see if the immunopath also is consistent, you can get a point for that. But those are minor criteria and they only get you a point. Moving on now to staging. So it's very important in the differentiation of plaque versus patch versus tumor because they all follow a very different kind of prognostic trajectory. To me, patch, when I was in medical school, we were taught that if you can palpate it or if you see the presence of scale, that is now a plaque regardless. In MF, the staging is a little bit different. What you're looking for, if the lesion is infiltrated or indurated, it doesn't matter if there's scale. So a lot of times people will say, oh, it's a plaque because you were taught, oh, if there's scaling or if there's any palpability whatsoever, that's a plaque. But in MF, what you're really looking for is like a thick, almost like a psoriasiform plaque where there's raised infiltrate present in the skin versus just the presence of scale, which would be more like a patch. And those patients with plaque stage disease follow a much worse course than patients with patch stage disease. And the formal stage is about the staging at the time of diagnosis. So stage doesn't change over time. Now you may say, okay, they've progressed to have lymph node involvement, or they've progressed to have plaques, or they've progressed to have tumors, but their original prognosis and how you follow whether or not they're going to live over time, you keep them on the same line. That's how you form those actuarial curves, which we'll look at in a minute. So their stage is the stage at the time they're diagnosed and doesn't change. And so you can look at things like the blood burden, and so blood staging, you're looking for a CD4 positive, CD7 negative greater than 40%, or a CD4 population with CD26 negativity greater than 30%. We'll talk more about blood staging in a minute. Patients with mycosis fungoides, remember I talked about how these patients are kind of generally immunosuppressed. And just like you might see in some of your CLL patients or CML patients, patients with other lymphomas are more prone to cutaneous basal cell squamous cell skin cancers. In fact, many of you have seen patients with lymphomas of other sorts. And just like patients that are on immunosuppression, patients that have lymphoma have decreased cutaneous immune surveillance. And decreased cutaneous immune surveillance means that they are going to develop skin cancers at a much greater rate than other patients. But the same is true in MF, where they have decreased immune surveillance generally, and their likelihood to develop other malignancies, they have a higher standard incidence ratio of many different malignancies. Now, this doesn't mean we have to go pan-scanning people the way that you would in a paraneoplastic syndrome like dermatomyositis, but it means that you want to make sure that these patients have had all the age-appropriate malignancy screenings, like colonoscopies and mammograms, et cetera. So essentially, staging 1A is patch or plaque less than 10%. 1B is patch or plaque greater than 10%. 2A, it's rare for me to diagnose a patient with a stage 2A. Stage 2A is essentially where you're like, oh, I see you have some like maybe shoddy lymphadenopathy, but the nodes don't seem big enough or concerning enough for me to go imaging them and like sticking a needle into them to see if you have involvement of those lymph nodes. Maybe there's just sort of some shoddy lymphadenopathy, but not what you would think of as being like concerning for lymphomatous involvement. The cutoff criteria for nodal assessment is 1.5 centimeters or greater. So if you have a lymph node that you palpate in a patient with MF, you can get an ultrasound first or a CT and see the sizing of that node. And if it's greater than 1.5, typically we would then recommend lymph node biopsy. 2B is any tumor. 3A is erythroderma, but without significant blood involvement. 3A is less than 5% blood involvement. And erythroderma is greater than 80% body surface area. So greater than 80% of their body is red, but less than 5% involvement in their blood. 3B is erythroderma, and they have less than 30% blood involvement, but greater than 5% blood involvement. 4A1 is where you have significant blood involvement, so you have a B2 status, so you have greater than 30% blood involvement. 4A2 is positive nodal disease, and 4B, which is where you have visceral metastases, which can be diagnosed by imaging criteria. I will tell you that I have not really had any patients. I've been doing this for 10 years, and I've not had patients with liver or splenic involvement, but I have had several patients that have had malignant pleural effusions that were their lymphoma cells. And so those patients presented with sudden onset of shortness of breath. And I've had a few patients that had PEs, because especially in Sézary syndrome, because any malignancy can make you hypercoagulable. So if you have a patient with lymphoma that all of a sudden is presenting with like extreme sudden onset of shortness of breath, those patients I always send to the ER, they get imaged, and then we kind of sort out what's going on with them. So just to sort of as an aside. So this is these are those actual aerial curves that I was mentioning earlier. So you keep people on the stage that they are at the time that they're diagnosed. And what I have here highlighted is sort of this oval highlighting the point that when you are at tumor stage disease, the survivability really drops off precipitously. And so that's why it's important to be able to know how to diagnose and stage these people appropriately, because it can help you to portend in your mind how aggressive you need to be in their treatment and how aggressive the disease course may follow in that person. Because a lot of patients that come in, mostly we get patients, fortunately, with this disease state that are diagnosed in this early stage 1A patch disease. And these patients, you're just spending a lot of time reassuring them that they're going to live just fine. But then you have patients with tumors, and let's say they're young. When I was a resident, even, I was taught, mycosis fungoides, it's the good lymphoma. People don't die of it. Nobody dies of this. It's fine. You're going to live a normal life expectancy. That's sort of like what I was taught and like what I read in the book. But what we find is that's not actually the case, particularly if you have tumors. And let's say you're a 30-year-old African-American female and you're showing signs of impetigenization early on in your disease course, that person is not going to have a normal life expectancy. They're going to die of their disease, because we're looking at trying to, if you're 30, average life expectancy is currently 75, you're looking at trying to squeeze 35 years out of their disease state and have them live a relatively normal life while doing it, and that's really hard to do. Now, if you're 80 and you have patch disease, you're fine. So, patch stage. what I do for this, I do a CBC, I do an LDH, and I just spend a lot of time reassuring them. Phototherapy is one of my favorite treatments. I sometimes use topical steroids just for symptomatic control if they have itch. I really like topical retinoids combined with phototherapy for these patients, though. So this slide here is to highlight hypertension-related deaths. You may be thinking, is she talking about hypertension-related deaths in a lymphoma talk? But this is because what I like to tell patients when they come in, let's say you're 70 and you have patch disease on two little areas of your buttocks, what I tell patients is, you know, if you have high blood pressure and it's not in good control, or you have diabetes and it's not in good control, or you have kidney problems and it's not well controlled, or you have bad physical mobility and you're likely to fall and break a hip at home, those are the things that are going to kill you. This condition of these little patches on your buttocks at age 70 is not going to be what changes your life expectancy. We'll do some phototherapy, we'll get this under control, but you're going to live a totally normal life. So I like to talk about the fact, because people, you know, this is an uncommon disease, and people hear lymphoma and they sort of freak out. But if you're 70, you're going to be okay. Whereas hypertension is a really common diagnosis that's relatively, or you have high cholesterol, let's say. Those are relatively, people sort of accept, oh yeah, I have high blood pressure, or I have high cholesterol, but I don't want to take a statin. And, you know, I spent a lot of time going, you know, these are the things that are actually going to reduce your morbidity and your mortality, or you falling at home and breaking a hip is really going to significantly change your life expectancy or your quality of life, and this disease state will not. Whereas plaque stage disease, particularly if they're impetigenized like you see on the foot of this patient, I look to see if there's signs of staph, and I treat if there's signs present, because staph and mycosis fungoides have a symbiotic relationship. Staph increases expression on cellular pathways that are already mutated in MF and can help to kind of propagate the development of the malignant cells. Again, if it's less than 10%, I tend to do just an LDH, a CBC, and a flow cytometry. If it's greater than 10%, I do all the same staging workup, as well as doing some imaging exams, potentially a CT. And then again, I really like narrowband UVB as my go-to treatment in almost all of my patients. I also sometimes use PUVA if they have a greater than FITS4 phenotype. And I also like the use of oral retinoids, particularly acitretin at low doses, 25 milligrams, about 3 times a week. That's off-label use, but it's part of the national it's NCCN guidelines. Acitretin is included as part of the therapeutic algorithm for MF. So off-label, but yet part of the NCCN guidelines. Oral targretin is also indicated, but is much more complex to manage. We'll get into that in a minute. I also like the use of topical immune modulators like imiquimod or mechlorethamine, and then we often use spot radiation. I think of spot radiation, have you guys ever had a psoriasis patient that you put on a biologic and like 90% of their psoriasis went away, but they have one little spot that's left and you're like, oh dang, okay, what are we gonna do with that? And you just do like some topical steroids, or maybe you have an eczema laser in your clinic and you do a little eczema just on that spot. So you do like a little spot treatment in addition to their systemic treatment. You guys have all done that, right? So, that's how I think of spot radiation in mycosis fungoides and Sézary syndrome. We put them in the light box, we put them on an oral retinoid, let's say, or a topical retinoid, and they're doing their phototherapy, and we're treating them generally, their whole body. But let's say they had tumors, or they had really thick plaques all over, and now you have one or two spots that are really stubborn, and they're, let's say, on their face, or on their hand, or someplace else that's clinically visible. And every time they go to the grocery store, people are like staring at them because they've got this spot on their face, or staring at them because they have this spot on their hand. And that's really annoying. And it's a malignancy. So you can put a steroid on it, or you can put a retinoid on it, and it might look better temporarily, but generally with discontinuation of use, those lesions will come back. So they're constantly in this cycle of reapplying, reapplying, and reapplying, and they can get steroid atrophy and all sorts of other issues with that. So we use spot radiation, and it literally obliterates and erases these areas at extremely low doses. So we wrote an article on this, and you can get clinical response and remission. You have to have a close relationship with a radiation oncologist that can do specialized treatment of localized electrons. So I would say kind of have a relationship if you decide this is your specialty, or refer to a center that you know is going to do this. But they don't need high doses of radiation in order to clear these lesions. Tumor stage disease, they always get imaged. Again, spot radiation can be used. We do LDH flow if we think we're going to put them on a systemic chemotherapeutic agent. We might check uric acid levels because you can get tumor lysis in patients with extreme tumor burdens. Again, we might use in this case we might use an oral retinoid plus interferon shots that are done once a week. We do an ECP to stage, or if they have blood involvement, extracorporeal photopheresis, and if they express CD30, we use brentuximab. So here with erythroderma, again, we're going to do a flow cytometry. Flow is always got to be part of the workup for an erythrodermic patient. I would argue that in any patient that's older that presents with erythroderma, you want to do a flow cytometry. And I put this slide in here because I see a lot of patients referred to me for erythroderma where they have a non-specific biopsy. What's important to know about erythroderma is it's an acute inflammatory state, or it could be a chronic inflammatory state. But 30% of biopsies in erythroderma are non-specific, even if the patient has Sézary syndrome. So the biopsy is useful for sort of like, okay, it's kind of looking more eczematous, or it's kind of looking more psoriasiform, or you know, you'll see almost eczematous and psoriasiform patterns, and maybe or maybe not you see malignant cells. If you don't see malignant cells, you have not effectively ruled out Sézary syndrome, because remember, the home of the Sézary cell is the bloodstream, not the skin. Even though it homes to the skin, it lives in the bloodstream. So the place to look for the malignant cell is the bloodstream. You don't look just to the skin for finding your malignant cell. So it's sort of like when I think about erythroderma and biopsying erythroderma, and that 30% of the findings are nonspecific, it's sort of like, let's say you biopsied a mole and someone said 30% of your melanocytic lesions could still be melanoma, even with the biopsy that says it's not melanoma. You'd never biopsy a mole again, because you'd be like, well, 2/3 of the time we'll know, but 1/3 of the time we won't, and you'd be like, I can't deal with that uncertainty. And so that's sort of how I think about biopsying erythroderma, is sort of like, okay, I'm going to get sort of like, I might get into the right lane. Like, okay, it looks eczematous. Okay, it looks psoriasiform, but I haven't really ruled out Sézary yet. It's kind of how I think about it. And then it sort of guides me. Okay, like, I think I'm here. I think I'm there. Maybe I want Dupixent. Maybe I want a biologic, but I still haven't ruled out Sézary. So how do I rule out Sézary? You have to do a flow cytometry and a TCR on the blood and tissue. And then patients that are erythrodermic are miserable. They want help, they're shedding skin, they're itching, they're just totally uncomfortable. So to me, what I do is I start phototherapy, I start really low-dose acitretin. Again, this is off-label, but the main differential here is it atopic derm, is it mycosis fungoides Sézary syndrome, is it medication-induced, or is it psoriasis? We do wet wraps, and sometimes we'll put them on gabapentin. I've used amitriptyline. These are all off-label for controlling their pruritus or their itch. Some people use hydroxyzine. I feel like we have mixed results with that. We sometimes use doxepin. So, oral bexarotene, the reason it's not my go-to compared to acitretin, at least as a first-line agent, is it requires twice-a-day dosing. It's always going to cause pan-dyslipidemia, low HDL, high LDL, high triglycerides. So they always require concomitant use of a statin, and it always causes a suppression of the TSH, so they get central hypothyroidism, so you have to monitor their free T4, and everyone has to start levothyroxine, and you have to monitor the free T4. So it's a lot of conversation, a lot of stuff to go over with your patients, and so it's pretty labor-intensive to start that drug. We do use it. I think it is slightly more effective than acitretin at much higher doses, but it comes with a lot of management issues. So in Sézary syndrome, it's really rare. It's 1 per million per year. It's more common in men than women. And again, it's a central memory T-cell malignancy. So what's the difference between flow cytometry and clonality? I had a hard time with that when I first started treating this disease as a specialty. I was like, okay, what's the difference between a flow and a clone? So a flow cytometry is where they put markers on your T cells and they're looking for the surface markers on that T cell and seeing does it express weird or abnormal surface markers that are signs of a malignant cell. So that would be a CD4 positive cell that is negative for CD26 and negative for CD7. That's sort of the classic phenotype of a Sézary cell. So 4 positive, 7 negative, 26 negative. If you have greater than 30% of those on the flow cytometry, that's Sézary syndrome, if there is also the presence of a clone. So what a clone is saying that, remember again, way back, this is why we went over the skin immunology, that APC and the T cell are interacting with each other, and then that T cell's like, I'm gonna make many of myself. So it secretes IL-2 and it begets many identical progeny. Right? And so they all express that same T cell receptor. So when one of those T cells becomes malignant and starts to self-propagate, they retain that identical T cell receptor. So a clonality is looking for, they put in primers to recapitulate that T cell receptor and see, oh, are there a whole bunch of cells that show the same surface T cell receptor and they're therefore identical so that you have a clone in the skin. So this is sort of how flow cytometry is done. You put your sample in, it's a blood sample. It can be done on solid tissue like a tumor, but it can't really be done on patch stage disease because you can't break out enough T cells from that sample. So it's typically a blood sample. You put all your markers in and then it's shot through a little tube and a computer reads it and it's like, yep, there's a whole bunch of these abnormal cells. Your lab has to know what you're looking for, so they have to know to do the 26 and the 7 primers in there to find the malignant cell. Now, clonality is different. They actually sequence out parts of the T cell chain. And one thing that I will say I get referrals for sometimes is that some labs will sequence out the beta chain, some labs will sequence out the gamma chain. If you see, oh, we sequenced the gamma receptor of the T cell and we found a clone, by this gamma receptor, blah, blah, blah. A lot of people read that and they're like, oh my gosh, it's a clone of gamma cell T cells. It's not a clone of gamma T cells. All T cells rearrange their gamma chain as well as their beta chain, as well as their alpha chain, when they're undergoing their original rearrangement to form their T cell receptor. And the gamma chain is just living dormant sort of in the nucleus. It's not expressed in the surface receptor necessarily, but it's part of the DNA of that cell. And so different labs use different primers. And so if you see a clone of, because they sequenced out the gamma chain, it doesn't mean it's a gamma delta T cell. Your lab can do a stain for the beta chain on the T cells to see if they're alpha beta or gamma delta T cells that are in the skin. So clonality, essentially, you may not find it in your skin. This can be done on the skin as well to see if the cells are identical. It only gives you 1 point towards the diagnostic criteria, though. Only 50% of patch patients are going to have a clone. 73% of plaques, virtually all tumor stage patients are going to show clonality in the studies. So what that says is that essentially unstable clones lead to a dominant clone. T cell receptor complexity is decreased. Essentially, they're dumb T cells. Their job in life is to become malignant and repropagate malignant cells. They don't really function as good immune cells that are designed to fight infections. And this leads to sort of an overall state of lymphopenia and immunosuppression. So what's important to know about clonality, let's say, for instance, you biopsy nickel dermatitis on someone's ear and you look for a clone, you may actually find one. So clonality does not mean malignancy, it just means a bunch of identical T cells. So in the skin sample, we had a bunch of identical T cells. If you biopsy nickel dermatitis, you might find a clone because you're like, oh, I've got a bunch of T cells that all recognize this nickel epitope. So it's important to always take clonality studies a little bit with a grain of salt. What is large cell transformation? You hear about that. It's a histologic diagnosis, but clinically it would present somewhat like this. You have a patient that has plaque stage disease that then progresses to develop tumors within that plaque and just becomes worse over time. So large cell transformation portends generally a very poor prognosis. And these patients, like this patient in this case, young African-American male, he was in his 30s when he was diagnosed. Despite all treatment, eventually succumbed to his disease about a year ago. CD30 positivity is a histopathologist or dermatopathologist cannot tell you when they see CD30 expression. All they can say is CD30 positive lymphoproliferative disorder. That's how your pathology report is always going to come back. CD30 positive lymphoproliferative disorder, and you're like, okay, what the heck do I do with this? I don't know what this means. It means something bad. There's a cancer or something maybe cancery like in the skin. And so your job is then to correlate CD30 positive lymphoproliferative disorder back to your clinical presentation of your patient and go, what do they look like? Because the way you determine what the patient, which of these bubbles the patient is living in, is based on your clinical correlation with that histology result. So LYP is going to be a bunch of evanescent lesions that come and go, typically. Transformed MF is going to show up like the patient in the last picture, where they have generalized MF and they have some tumors or some nodules developing within it. Or they have a big fixed tumoral area in one site that's just been sticking around over time. And that's the only lesion that they have, and that's cutaneous ALCL. So LYP can look many times as misdiagnosed as bug bites. It's many times misdiagnosed as folliculitis. They may think that they have, you may think they have prurigo nodularis. You know, you may think they have a lot of different things. But then you biopsy it, this, folliculitis that hasn't been responding to topicals, or this Grover's that hasn't been responding to topicals. And then, oh my gosh, there's a CD30 positive lymphoproliferative disorder. But you've been following this patient for 5 years, and then you feel, oh gosh, I feel so bad. They've got LYP, I missed it. But don't forgive yourself. Go, this is a really rare diagnosis. It happens in like one of a million people. Folliculitis happens in lots of people. It's okay. No, most people don't die of LYP. LYP is lymphoproliferative. It's not lymphoma. So patients respond exceedingly well to methotrexate. Here's a patient that presented rather acutely. He's now in remission from his LYP. But he actually got back from a camping trip, and he actually was told that he went to an urgent care, and they're like, oh, you got a bunch of chigger bites. And we actually wrote up this case as not bitten by the bug because he did not have chigger bites, or maybe he did get chigger bites and that precipitated his LYP. We'll never know. We don't know why people get these diseases. So here's a patient, just to demonstrate. This is a patient that had pagetoid reticulosis. She had been told for a long time she had either psoriasis or that she had atopic dermatitis or foot dermatitis or contact dermatitis. And then someone eventually was like, you're not responding to all the traditional first-line treatments. She'd been given lots of different topical steroids. And they were like, oh my gosh, you have mycosis fungoides. But it was just on her feet. And then part of how she was diagnosed was that she started to develop these little papules within it that were sort of coming and going as little sores. And someone biopsied it, and she had also a CD30 positive lymphoproliferative disorder. So they're like, they biopsied the plaque, and they're like, and so this poor girl, she was like, she's like in her 30s. She's like, oh my gosh, like I have had this for a long time, but I had the benefit when I saw her of like, you've had this for like 6 years, and now you just start developing these lesions within it. So she had pagetoid reticulosis version of MF. There were fixed lesions just on her feet. And then she had these little evanescent papulonecrotic lesions developing within it with CD30. And someone was like, maybe you have transformed MF. And I'm like, but they're coming and going on their own. That's LYP. And about 20% of patients with LYP can have a concomitant lymphoma, usually mycosis fungoides. And sometimes, for some reason, I don't know why, LYP has a preponderance to want to show up in the lesions of the MF, but they kind of come and go, sometimes with outside the area. So I saw her, and I'm like, we're going to do some spot radiation, baby dose, you'll be fine. And then, it depends on how many of these LYP lesions you get and that are coming and going, but we'll deal with them. And this is her, I don't know if you can appreciate this, but this is her just a month and a half, which it takes 3 months to respond to radiation, but this is just a month and a half after getting just 8 gray of radiation to her feet. And her feet have totally cleared. She's walking normally. She's super happy. And she kind of freaked out because she got another LYP lesion in it. And I was like, you know, I really think that's going to go away. We did some betamethasone. I did a little steroid injection into it. And I was like, let me know in a month. I think it's going to be gone. And she messaged me and she's like, you're right. That spot went away. I'm really happy. And then this is just an atypical presentation of LYP. It's the vascular variant of LYP. So, and here are two patients with cutaneous ALCL. You can see they look more like fixed tumors. They're almost keloidal looking. They almost have a squamous cell carcinoma look. They're real hard and firm. And sometimes you don't really know what category, LYP, MF, ALCL, to put the patient in. But if you follow them over time, you kind of can say, okay, I think you're more in this bucket. So you have the benefit of time. The drugs that we use, there's a lot of different drugs that are under study for the treatment of MF and Sézary syndrome. The ones we use most commonly for chemotherapeutic agents are the histone deacetylase inhibitors like romidepsin. We also use brentuximab if they express CD30. It's a monoclonal antibody against CD30. And then we use an anti-CCR4. That's a skin homing molecule on the surface of cutaneous T cells that targets those cells. This is why I'm such a fan of phototherapy. Phototherapy can put patients into remission, even off of therapy. So this is looking at patients that are stage 1A over time. Patients that achieve clinical complete remission or complete response maintain that response when they're tapered over time over about a 6 month period. At 5 years, over half of those patients remain in remission off of therapy. This would be analogous to in other solid malignancies of like remission from their disease. So like breast cancer, we scan you, there's no signs of your breast cancer, we follow you for 5 years. Now it may come back later on, but they've achieved remission for 5 years off of therapy. So phototherapy is highly effective, particularly in young, early stage, patch stage disease patients, and I think is a therapeutic agent that is one of my most preferred. Now, total skin electron beam can also be used. Here's a patient who was getting very impetiginized from his MF. He had already failed several therapies. You can use radiation to the whole skin. That's called total skin electron beam. It also is done at low doses as sort of a bridge. It's kind of like when you have an atopic patient and you put them on a steroid and you're like, this is a bridge to get you to whatever drug we're going to put you on. So we sort of use it to kind of quiet and calm the skin so they don't get septic. Typically, when patients die of MF, they actually don't die of the skin involvement. They die because they get an infection through the skin into the bloodstream and they end up succumbing to sepsis. This is also why I'm a big fan of, you know, I talked about the patient that may clear their whole body but have one area that's stubborn, or even just one, let's say a patient comes in with early stage disease and it's just one patch here. We may sometimes even use radiation on that and say this is the only thing we're going to do and see if it clears it. And this is why I like that. So the important part to note in this slide, let's see, I'm trying to figure out where I can point the best, this first graph is the composite index lesion severity. So the dark gray bar denotes radiation, and the gray bar is topical steroids. So this is, and this graph here is the person who got radiation. This graph here is the patient who had a topical steroid use. And you're looking at this and you're thinking, well, Heather, why are you showing us this? Radiation works the same as steroids. They're totally the same. They were bad before, after radiation they're better, topical steroid before, topical steroid after, they both look better. And that's true if you just look at the clinical presentation. So you're like, oh, yep, radiation, better. Index lesion severity down to zero. Gray line, yep, bad, afterwards totally better. Now, this graph here is what's called high throughput sequencing. And this is why I like radiation more as a spot treatment. Before, they're looking at the malignant T cell population, and they're sequencing out through high throughput. So they're sequencing every cell in that sample. And what they found is that after radiation, all those malignant cells are essentially gone. But with high throughput sequencing with the topical corticosteroid group, you look, and afterwards, the malignant population is still there. Why is that? You're like, what the heck? I thought you just showed me they look better. What the thought is that there's the you know, it's a big buzzword now in the treatment of all cancers, but the tumor microenvironment. When you're putting a steroid on, you're like, calm, calm, now, now, there, immune system, just chill out, it's okay. And what you're doing is you have all these malignant cells and you have your healthy immune system that's like, ah, cancer, we should fight it. And then the malignant cells are also secreting cytokines and that's triggering other inflammation. And there's this little battle going on in the skin. And when you put a steroid on, you're like, everybody just chill out. But you're not killing any cells. You're just sort of getting the area to calm. And so I like steroids for symptomatic control. Like, hey, I'm really itchy all over. Steroids are great. So when patients come in to see me, I'm like, you know what? I like steroids. I'm not an anti-steroid person. Steroids do work, and they help control your itch. And if I control your itch so you're not introducing bacteria and you're not breaking your skin down, and we're keeping your skin functional and healthy and intact to where you're not breaking it open and you're going to die of sepsis because you're scratching so badly, I won that battle. So it's good to use a steroid. But I don't think of it as a curative. I don't ever go, yay, you're all better, because I know probably those cancerous cells are still there. So in PUVA, I only like PUVA in kind of low burden, early stage disease patients and only in dark-skinned patients. Because dark skin by medium brown to darker brown, so sort of like a FITS 4 to a FITS 6. I don't use it in the FITS 1, 2s, and 3s because most patients are going to have this for a long time. And if you follow them 20, 30 years and they've gotten PUVA, you're going to be now not managing their MF. You're going to be managing all their melanomas and squamous cells and basal cell skin cancers that you've induced by giving them lots of PUVA. So patients, this slide is here just to say that patients with high burden of disease actually increase the malignant cells, but patients with low burden of disease actually decrease the malignant cells. So PUVA is sort of like a double-edged sword. It works in some and not in others. Narrowband seems to work better more generally for everyone. I was taught that narrowband didn't go deep enough to get folliculotropic because it only works at the surface of the skin, but my belief is that narrowband is more immunomodulating than PUVA is. You need UVB to induce vitamin D production in your skin. That increases cell-mediated immunity. This is a lot of hand-waving on my part. It's mostly conjecture at this point, but I think UVB is a little bit more disease-modifying than UVA. That's my opinion, though. This is just showing the use of brentuximab in a patient with ALCL. She at first did not want to get radiation. She also did not want to get chemo, so we excised the lesion per her preference. It recurred along the suture line. We then were able to convince her to do brentuximab and she cleared her, her tumor. Here's a patient with Sézary that also had a lot of cutaneous infiltration. He had lionine facies and a lot of folliculotropic involvement, complete loss of his eyebrows, loss of a lot of his facial hair, came in just shedding tons of skin. We found CD30 expression in his blood and we put him on brentuximab and he cleared that infiltrate in his skin and lived a pretty normal life for quite a while. Here's a patient that, like, you know, 2 decades ago would have just expired of her disease almost, you know, within months. And she's a patient that we would check a uric acid level because she had really high tumor involvement at the time of her presentation. And so she would be someone that could potentially undergo tumor lysis. We put her on brentuximab, which actually is a toxin that's isolated from the sea hair, and it's essentially a microtubule inhibitor that's like many more times potent than vincristine and vinblastine, so it can cause neuropathy. And so with brentuximab, she cleared all of her tumors and also went to live a pretty normal life. Here's a patient again with ALCL. This is just showing that essentially this is a toxin conjugated to a monoclonal antibody that binds to CD30. It's endocytosed. Once it's endocytosed in the cytoplasm, that toxin is cleaved and released and acts like a smart bomb inside of the cell to cause tumor lysis. Anti-CCR4 monoclonal antibody, mogamulizumab, causes antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity and antibody-dependent cellular phagocytosis within the skin and can also help control. It works a little better in Sézary syndrome than in MF, but it is very effective and doesn't have as many side effects as things like histone deacetylase inhibitors. So, sorry, it's a lot of information. What are the main ideas? The main ideas is that your immune system changes over time from the time you're in infancy to the time that you're an adult. This may cause a preponderance of these malignancies later in life, but I think also, remember, explains a lot of these immune presentations of rashes that we see in infancy as well, because your immune system is not as mature yet. There are phenotypic differences between patches and plaques and tumors that probably has to do with the degree to which the T cells are epidermally restricted or not. Patch being very epidermally restricted, plaque being less epidermally restricted, and tumor being the least epidermally restricted with the greatest preponderance to spread and cause metastatic disease or blood involvement. And then when do I worry and what do we do? I always like to know, when did this occur? What's the history before they were diagnosed? Because patients will come in, they're like, I've had this rash for 10 years and I was always told it was eczema. Now it's biopsy and they found that I've got this lymphoma. I'm like, okay, you've probably had this for 10 years. I can then, you know, the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior. If it's been going fine for 10 years with like nothing, I'd spend a lot of time reassuring this patient. But when do I worry? If I see a young person with plaque disease, young I would say is less than 50. Impetiginized at any stage of disease is always bad, especially if it's plaques greater than 10%. Another thing to remember is that they may have tumors that are ulcerated and weeping and oozing. They may have plaques that are ulcerated and, and weeping. And you can send them to wound care. You can help tell them to do all this like cleansing and whatnot at home. But it's sort of like if you had an ulcerated basal cell or an ulcerated melanoma, you can send them to wound care. It may help a little, but you will not cure a basal cell by wound caring it. And when I say that, the residents that I work with are always like, yeah, you're right, you can't wound care a basal cell into healing because it's a cancer. So you can't wound care MF tumors, you can't wound care MF plaques into remission by just doing good skin care. They have to be radiated, they have to be put on drugs, they have to be treated in some way for their malignancy, but wound care is still important so they don't get secondarily infected because that's how patients die. Worsening blood involvement, and then control infections by controlling the disease, but remember that staph has a symbiotic relationship with MF, so you control infections by controlling the disease, but you control the disease by also controlling their infections. It seems like a, you know, like one of the snake eating its tail sort of things, but it is a little bit like that, especially in later stages. Overall, the disease is a state of overwhelming immunodeficiency and immunosuppression, which leads to greater disease progression, and remember to screen for secondary malignancies if you think they may be present. And that's it. Sorry, it's a lot of information.